concerned, so I'm going to not give classes that week, so we'll take a break. I think you owe me a homework assignment today, so I'll be collecting that well, either today or this morning or this afternoon. This is the announcement for the second homework assignment, which is going to be due, well, in a couple of weeks, well, February 27th. And there are four problems from chapter two and one problem from chapter three. And I'm hoping that probably by the end of today, we'll get started on chapter three. So, we started out with having a look at time-like congruences, so congruences of time-like geodesics, and at the end of the last lecture, we actually came to grips with understanding what happens when you take the limit where your time-like congruence turns into a null congruence, and there's some interesting subtleties that are associated with that transition. So I want to just go back to that a little bit, and then move forward. So I was looking at this. So we're back in talking about null congruences. And while I was thinking of that very specific example where we work in flat space time and we have, I'll try to restore one of the suppressed dimensions. So time goes up and space goes sideways. And I was talking about those time-like geodesics that are shooting off from the origin from the z-axis and define. So you have particles shooting off from all the same point with the same speed, and it's a speed that's less than the speed of light, and the word lines, the time-like geodesics in this case, are straight lines that live on that cone, which has a slope which is larger than unity, and that means that particles are moving with a speed smaller than the speed of light. So that's the cone that's defined by the geodesics themselves, and what we saw is that congruence of time-like geodesics is actually orthogonal to hypersurfaces, which are also conical in shape. And those hypersurfaces, so this is the cone of the geodesics. And there's going to be a larger cone with slope that's smaller than one, which is going to be the conical surface, which is orthogonal to this congruence of time-like geodesics. So here I'm just drawing two cones, but there's a whole stack of them. So this is the hypersurface to which the congruence is orthogonal. And what we have in the time-like situation is a hypersurface, which is a space-like hypersurface. If the normal to that is time-like, the hypersurface itself has to be space-like. We have on the hypersurface, we have topologically a three-dimensional surface. Metrically, it's also a three-dimensional surface because there's, a finite, there's a non-zero space-time distance along the direction, the radial direction that goes away from the origin. So there's distance, space-time distance associated with that direction. And we also have the directions, along the circle, along the circle over here, which is really a spherical surface. So we have, two angles along the sphere and the radial coordinate, and we have, space-time intervals associated with each of those three-dimensional displacements. So the point is that we have hypersurface, which is topologically three-dimensional, but also metrically three-dimensional. And I point this out because when we then take the limit where the time-like geodesics turn into null geodesics, what happens to those cones is that they move out like that, and they'll reach the limit at 45 degrees, while the hypersurface cones move in, and in the limit, the cones coincide. So in the limit, that picture goes into the following picture, where we have only one set of cones, and they're both at 45 degrees. So in the limit, we have the geodesics moving along the cone, that's the light cone, and we have the hypersurfaces taking the limit also, where the hypersurfaces become also the null cone. So in this limit, we have the geodesics and the hypersurface defined the same, you know, the same structure in space-time. So in this case, we have the geodesics plus the hypersurface. And one thing that happens when you take the limit is that, you know, topologically, we're still dealing with three-dimensional hypersurface, but metrically, things have changed because now the radial direction as we go along the cone is now in all directions. There's no space-time interval in that direction because that's the, you know, that's the path of null geodesics. So what happens is that what survives symmetrically are purely the two-dimensional directions associated with the sphere along the cone here drawn as a circle. So as we take the limit, we go from a transverse space, which is on the hypersurface, which is metrically three-dimensional, to a transverse space, which in the null case becomes two-dimensional. We're still dealing with three-dimensional topological surface, but metrically it has become a two-dimensional surface. Associated with that loss of one dimension is the fact that if we have the tangent vector field in the geodesics denoted K, if we have that running along the cone, this is a vector which is orthogonal to itself, which means that it's also the normal vector to the surfaces, which is K, is orthogonal to itself, which means that that's one's tangent, you know, it's normal and tangent to the hypersurface. So K is tangent to the geodesics. It's the null vector that's tangent to the geodesic. It's also normal to the hypersurface. But because it's orthogonal to itself, and because, you know, the geodesics lie on the hypersurface, so the meaning of hypersurface orthogonality has changed. Before, we were truly talking about orthogonal directions. Here, the meaning has become ambiguous because of the null limit. The geodesics are on the hypersurface, but they're still called hypersurface orthogonal because the notion, you know, we use the same definition. We use the same terminology as to take the limit. So in this case, we have K being tangent to the geodesics. It's defined to be normal to the hypersurface, but it's also tangent to the hypersurface. And of course, both properties can be true because K is orthogonal to itself. Associated with that fact also is the fact that metrically we've lost a dimension because there's no space-time interval along the cone. The only two surviving metric dimensions are the two-dimensional dimensions associated with the spheres. And this is what we're going to call the transverse space. So before, the transverse space was this full three-dimensional thing. But now the transverse space has become two-dimensional. We've lost one dimension. And in order to properly isolate this, what we saw last time is that we need to introduce an additional vector that we didn't have to introduce before. Now we need this extra vector to properly, isolate, identify the transverse space. So we have one null vector that's going to be going along the cone. And what we're going to do is to introduce one of the other null directions that's not unique. So it's, you know, one of the other null directions, which it's not going to be very clear in the diagram, but you have to think of this as pointing inside the null cone. So it's not on the surface, it's going to be pointing in toward the center. So n alpha is this, you know, additional null vector. If I suppress one dimension from this, we have the null cone going like this. We have the vector k going in that null direction, and vector n is going in to the other null direction. I say the other null direction. That's misleading because, in fact, there's a whole bunch of null directions that are, in a sense, orthogonal to that one, and we have the freedom of rotating this vector around the cone. But anyway, as we're going to see, there's, you know, there's non-uniqueness. We talked about that, but this additional null vector is not unique, and therefore the transfer space is not going to be defined in a perfectly unique fashion. There's going to be some ambiguities associated with that, and what we're going to see later on in this lecture is the fact that this ambiguity is not important for anything that we have to say about behavior of the congruence and its transverse properties. In fact, the ambiguity really plays no role. It's not important at all. So N is the auxiliary I don't have to spell Z. Is that it? Let's fix it. Auxiliary null direction, null vector field. And what we're going to do is to pick a vector like this, which will have to satisfy two properties, but only two. First is that the vector has to be null. And the other one is that the vector will be normalized in such a way that its inner product with K is going to be chosen to be minus 1. This condition, of course, does specify the normalization of the vector. This is the condition that specifies its normalization. And I pick minus 1 because it turns out to be convenient in the expression for the transverse metric that I wrote down last time. The transverse metric is going to be conveniently expressed if you use this normalization condition. Okay, and the last thing that we saw last time was that, well, we can properly identify the transverse space now as saying that it's going to be all directions in spacetime that are going to be orthogonal to both K and N. And in this diagram, if, you know, if K points that way, N points that way, well, we're talking about you know, the directions that come up forward, but you know, in this diagram right here, if K points in the cone and points inside the cone, we're talking about all the directions that are defined on the sphere. So that two-dimensional sphere over here is what's going to be called transverse space, you know, and the sphere is isotropic, so there was lots of ways you can rotate it, and it's still, in this case, the same transverse space. In more simple situations where, you know, we wouldn't be dealing with 2d6 in flat space-time, the transverse space on the rotations would, you know, change metrically, but that's fine. We can live with that, and, you know, there's no problem in dealing with that ambiguity. You have a question?
I'm just not confused as to how you can say that N and K are orthogonal to each other in the operator product.
Yeah, that's where the language becomes difficult when you deal with the null situation. So they're not orthogonal in the sense,
in the usual sense, right? So the problem is that K is orthogonal to itself, N is orthogonal to itself, and N and K are not, you know, perceived to be orthogonal according to the usual standard definitions. However, when you look at it on a diagram like this, you have one vector pointing that way, one vector pointing that way, and at least graphically they look orthogonal, and that's what I meant. So instead of orthogonal, what I should really say is that we have one null direction this way, and we have an independent null direction going that way, and K and N denote two independent null directions. But yeah, so I'll be guilty of slips of language every now and then, but that's, so in that sense, I'm using orthogonality in a misleading, you know, unusual way. Okay, so all of this I think will become a little bit clearer when I go through, you know, mathematical examples. So I'll come back to that in a little bit later, but for now I just want to, you know, continue with the theory, and we'll consider an example a little bit later on, and I think that the ideas will become a bit more concrete. So in this construction we have a transverse space which is metrically two-dimensional. And the definition of what transverse space is going to be that it has to be orthogonal to both N and K. So in time like this, it was enough to say that the orthogonal directions would be orthogonal to U, would be, you know, orthogonal to the vector U. In this case, again, because K is orthogonal to itself, anything on K is orthogonal to K. So so we need to say more, and that's why now we need to say that it has to be orthogonal to two vectors. And of course, if you start with four dimensions and you isolate two directions in space-time, you're left with two, you know, dimensions. And those are, you know, this is the two-dimensional transverse space. And in a diagram, the transverse space is really the space along the circle over here, or if I were to restore the third dimension, it would be the sphere space that comes with the light point. So we have the transverse space, and having identified those vectors, and obviously there's an ambiguity, there's a non-uniqueness involved here, because I have only two conditions to specify a four-dimensional vector. So obviously there's going to be two, you know, there are two missing conditions that tell me that, well, there's going to be more solutions to n that there are equations. That's the ambiguity I was talking about, that's the non-uniqueness I was talking about. And again, we'll see that we can live with this non-uniqueness, it's not a problem. And it doesn't create any significant obstacles in what we're going to be doing next. We have the transverse space, and we have the transverse metric, which acts as a projection operator into that two-dimensional transverse space. And what we saw last time was that the transverse metric was given by the full metric, but then you get rid of the two extra dimensions by using this combination of k and n. And here, I think, yeah, I have the right slide. So that's the transverse metric, and it has, you know, a couple of key properties. One is the fact that the trace of that transverse metric is equal to 2, because the trace of G is 4, but the inner product of K and N is minus 1, so we have 4 minus 1 minus 1, and that gives us 2. And another property is the fact that if you project twice, it's like projecting only once, and you can check that this identity of, you know, this projective identity is satisfied by that vector H. So you just calculate the square of that and do all the cancellations, and you get H back. So that's an important property, and that, you know, tells us that H really does have this behavior, you know, behaves as a projection operator. And the other important property, of course, is that H, being a projector to the transfer space, has to be orthogonal to both K and N. Well, we can verify that. We can verify that H is proportional, is orthogonal to K, because if, you know, if we multiply the right side by K, we can K, we get K back from here, but we get minus K from here, and we get zero from here. And the same story holds for N. If we multiply on the right by N, we get N back to here, we get zero from here, and we get minus N from here. So H is guaranteed to be orthogonal to both K and N, and that's precisely what we need for a transverse projector. Okay, so I think that's where we were last time. And what we also had was the, you know, the construction associated with the congruence of null geodesics. So all of that we had previously in the time-like case survives here as well. So we have a whole bunch of null geodesics, that's our congruence. And by doing exactly the same cross curve construction, we have a notion of deviation vector between nearby null geodesics. And the whole construction that we made for the time-like case just carries over unchanged for the null case. And, you know, all the relationship that we worked out, the fact that K and C are Lie transported along each other, that survives. So that gives us the equation that says that the rate of change of the deviation vector in the direction of K is equal to the rate of change of K in the direction of C. So that's the equation of Lie transport that comes for free given the geometric construction. We also have that this equation guarantees that if K starts out to be orthogonal to C initially, this will be preserved at all times on the reference to geodesic, which is this one right here. And basically, well, we have that, and we also have the geodesic equation for K. And what we're going to try to do now is to go through the procedure of trying to figure out what the transverse behavior of the congruence is going to be, what the deviation vector is going to be as a function of time, work out kinematics for this, decompose this guy into irreducible components, expansion, shear, and rotation, and then work out the evolution equation for the expansion and do all the stuff that we did for the time-like case, but now in the null case. And it's basically the same story, except for that, you know, that sort of vexing feature of the fact that this equation, which, in the time-like case, is telling us that C was always orthogonal to U, and therefore C was in the transverse space. Here, this equation doesn't rule out the possibility that C could have a component along K, and therefore may not be purely transverse in the sense we want to use in this case. So the first thing I'm going to have to do in order to work everything through is to make sure that the deviation vector is purely transverse in the refined sense of the word. So we're going to have to make sure that C is not just, it's not only orthogonal to K, but it's also orthogonal to N as well. And then we're going to have to keep doing this because, you know, before when we worked, so that before in time-like case, the deviation vector was guaranteed to be orthogonal, to be in the transverse space. The transverse velocity was also in the transverse space. Everything was automatically in the transverse space without having to think or, you know, do any extra work. Whereas in this case, we're going to have every time we take projections to bring everything back into transverse space. And it's only when we do that that we'll have a proper, discussion, a proper setup to discuss the transverse property of congruence. And what I want to know is, you know, the basic question is that having selected my reference null 2Ds, I want to know relative to that one what's happening in the transverse directions. I want to know whether the congruence is expanding or contracting. Those are all questions that are, you know, that are framed in the context of the transverse space, but now we have to put more work into defining this property and making sure that everything is, correctly projected into the transverse space. Okay. So, well, let's do it. So, this equation does not rule out a component of C along K. Sorry?
Not along K.
If C is orthogonal to K and K is orthogonal to K, a component of C along K is not going to be ruled out. So we need to rule this out. So what I'm going to do is to just use the projection operator. If I use the projection operator on any vector, the end result is going to be guaranteed to be orthogonal to K and N by virtue of those relations right here. So what I'm going to do is to define a projected deviation vector. Which I'll denote C tilde alpha. So the tilde notation is going to be telling us that we've projected. So every time there's a tilde, that means that projection has been made. And by definition, this is going to be H alpha mu operating on the original vector. And that is guaranteed to be orthogonal to K and N because H itself, by virtue of those relations over there, is orthogonal to H and N, to K and N. So this is automatically orthogonal to both K and N. And if we have that, that means that this is really a vector that's defined in the, you know, appropriate tangent space that we get after, you know, selecting our auxiliary null vector M. Well, what is this concretely? Well, we just write down what K is in terms of K and the metric K and N. And what we get is that, well, we get the original vector back by acting with the metric, And then we get something along K, which involves the inner product between N and C. And then we get nothing because this is zero. So what's the meaning of this equation? Well, the meaning of this equation is that this could have component along K, and this term cancels it out. This term kills it off. So we have component of C along K if C has an inner product, non-vanishing inner product with M. So that's where, you know, what is a function to which becomes a little bit tricky to describe. So if this is not zero, I would say, you know, I would normally say that C has a component along N, but it's actually a component along K. And that's what this equation tells us. So bottom line is that if this has a component along K, it will be killed off by this additional term, here. And what remains in the end, the tilde quantity, is guaranteed to be orthogonal to both K and N, and therefore that fits purely in the transverse space. So try to work your brain around that. So if C has an inner product with N that's not zero, it has a component along K, and the other way around is true. Okay. So that's the projected deviation vector. And what we would like to do is to construct, you know, a transverse velocity associated with that. So the transverse velocity our first guess might be that it's just the derivative of that vector along K. Let's see. We'll try that. So if I construct the derivative of this deviation vector along K, well, let's see what we get. Well, okay, so I'll go back to the original form of the definition. So we have the projection operator acting on C, all of that's being differentiated, and we're differentiating in the direction of K. If we work this out, we're going to get two terms. The first term we're going to get is this term right here, where we differentiate the original deviation vector. But we get a second term, which comes from the derivative of the projection operator. And we have to worry about this one because this one is guaranteed to be in the transverse space. So this is a properly transverse velocity. But this guy we don't know yet. We have to look at this and see whether it has non-transverse components. And if it does, I'll have to kill them to properly define transverse velocity. So something that really is a vector that lives in the transverse space. Again, in a time like this, we didn't need to worry about all that because it all came out automatically. But in all case, I mean, if we're going to be working in the transverse space, we have to be sure that at every step, we're building vectors that only have transverse components, that do not have components along K and N. So I need to look at this guy over here, and I need to work out the covariant derivative of projection operator. So we have an expression for it there. I don't need to worry about differentiating the metric. But I need to worry about differentiating the rest of it. So first of all, so we get a bunch of terms here. So first of all, we get K alpha differentiated with respect to beta, and then N mu is left alone. And then we have K alpha with N mu to be differentiated in the direction of K. And then we have N alpha differentiated with respect to beta times K mu. And then have an alpha k mu differentiated with respect to beta. This simplifies because, you know, I'm actually calculating derivatives in the direction of k. And the derivative of k in the direction of k is zero because k satisfies the two-digit equation. So I can get rid of this term, and I can get rid of this term as well. So what do we get? We get that the uh, we get the derivative of the transverse velocity is going to be h alpha mu. Multiplying the derivative of the original deviation vector, and then we have a couple of extra terms. We have a term in the direction of k, which involves n mu differentiated with respect to beta, and that multiplies c mu k beta. And then we have direction, we have something else that's going to be n alpha differentiated with beta. Don't need to keep this. Because this term right here involves k that multiplies c. And those vectors are orthogonal to the usual sense of having a zero in a product. So I can get rid of that as well. So I had to worry about this term because it does produce a term which is not pure transverse. This term is pure transverse. This term is in the direction of k, and I don't want that as being part of the description of the transverse velocity. So our guess is slightly wrong because it produces something which doesn't have, you know, a pure transverse direction. There's still a longitudinal term that I want to get rid of. And to get rid of this, to say that, well, the transverse velocity is not going to be this. It's going to be this projected again with the projection operator. So the transverse velocity then the correct expression for it is going to be this projected down to the transverse space. So it's going to be, in the notes I have this notation right here. So I take the vector that I've got over here and I project it. So that would be, you know, notation for that. But probably it's better to use more explicit notation where I'll say that it's going to be h, it's going to be h alpha mu acting on x alpha mu. In the direction of k. So this is the definition for the transverse velocity, the correct expression for it. And it's going to be all this projected down, which means that effectively I just kill off that term and keep two projection operators here. So what we have, h alpha mu. This equation gives, I've replaced alpha by mu, so I can this. And I could use the property of the transverse operator, transverse projector, that operating with this twice is equal to operating with this once, and I can all boil it down to this expression right here. And that is the transverse velocity. The next step that I'm going to use is to replace this derivative by that. And then we're going to have what is the, what is in the null case, the equivalent to the B field that we had in the time-like case, which is defined to be the gradient of the velocity field of the congruence. So now we're going to be dealing with the gradient of the null tangent vector field to the congruence. All right, so essentially we're all stuck with the construction. And what we have at this stage is that the transverse velocity of congruence is going to be given by h alpha mu, and it's going to be given by k mu differentiated with respect to beta, and then multiplied in the direction of c itself. And I'll use notation b alpha beta for gradient of the tangent, the field sine of agent that we had for time-like space. And what I have is this equation. All right. I'm still not quite there where I want to be. And the reason for this is because here I have the right-hand side expressed in terms of the original deviation vectors, and I just want to clean this up and re-involve the projected quantity. So what I'll do here is just say that, well, C can be expressed as C tilde. Do I still have that expression? Let's see. Oh, yeah, it's over there. Minus k, k beta, and then nu, well, the good thing about this is that this term actually doesn't contribute, because by virtue of the geodesic equation, multiplying b by k gives me zero. So B alpha beta times K beta is actually zero. So I can actually kill off that term. So now we're almost there. But I'll do one extra thing. What I'll do is to re-express this guy as further action of projection operator. So to get C out, C tilde, I've used the projection operator once. Here I want to use it again. It doesn't change the result. Once I've projected once, projecting again doesn't do anything more. But the reason why I would want to do this is because I consider this as a package, and this will be the purely transverse, version of the tensor B. After doing two projection operators on the tensor B, I get fully projected transverse B field, and this part will be tilde. So the final form of the equation, the one that we're going to proceed with, is going to be that. So the transverse velocity, I'll still use the notation that I introduced before. So the fully projected transverse velocity of the confluence is going to be a fully projected B field multiplying, how do I write this? Oh, God, right. That form, multiplying the transverse velocity, the transverse deviation vector. And the fully projected B is obtained by projecting the original B field, which is, of course, the tangent, the great tangent vector field. Okay, so I've just cleaned up the indices over there, but mostly they take care of themselves. B tilde, of course, is the fully projected version of B, so it involves two projection operators. The indices have to be involved that way. And by doing that, we're making sure that the right side is fully transverse, and of course, that agrees with the fact that the left side has to be fully transverse. And that is the equivalent to the starting point we had in a time-like case. Now we have everything properly formulated in the two-dimensional transverse space. And it's going to be B tilde that we're going to want to decompose into irreducible pieces. It wouldn't work to do it with B directly, because while B, in fact, can work out, B is orthogonal to K. You know, it's orthogonal on the right. It's also orthogonal on the left by virtue of the fact that K alpha has zero length. B is orthogonal to K, but it's not orthogonal to N. So to decompose B would give us also stuff in the transverse directions, but also extra stuff in the, you know, direction of either K or M, depending on how you put it. I don't want to deal with that, you know, those extra components of B, and I won't have to if I'm decomposing B tilde instead. So B tilde will have position. But again, that's purely involved transverse quantities defined in transverse space that we get once we have selected the null vector field M. Okay. So I'll just write down a couple more, equations, and then we'll try to do this, you know, more concretely in, you know, in a specific example. So B tilde is decomposed into irreducible components. And the way we do it is the same way we did it before. We're going to introduce a trace term, which will be called the expansion of our congruence. The trace term would involve the transverse metric H alpha beta, and the coefficient front is not going to be 1/3, it's going to be 1/2, because the trace base is 2, not 3. So the 1/2 versus 1/3 has to do with the fact that here the transverse space is 2-dimensional and not 3-dimensional, as in the old situation. So we have a trace term, we have a symmetric trace free term, which is the shear tensor, and we have an antisymmetric term, which is the rotation tensor. So theta is the trace of B tilde. Called the expansion. Sigma is going to be the symmetric trace free part. So what you do first is to symmetrize B tilde, and then you remove the trace term. That's the shear tensor. And omega is the rotation tensor. That's the antisymmetric piece of B tilde. We can say a little bit more about theta. Theta is going to be really the quantity that's going to be interesting the most. Theta is a trace of B tilde, which means that the axon metric on B tilde, which means that the axonometric on this whole set of quantities, right? Well, if I axonometric on the first H, I get H mu beta multiplying H nu beta. But here I'm acting twice with projection operator, so it's just this good to act only once. So I can rewrite this as H mu nu acting on K mu nu. And I can write this down in more explicit form by just using the definition for H. So we have metric, and then we have K mu and nu plus N mu K nu. This term goes away because of the geodesic equation. This term goes away because K mu multiplying the derivative is like half the derivative operator acting on K mu squared. But that's zero. So this term goes away as well. And what's left is the metric acting on the gradient of the vector field, and that defines the divergence of the vector. So bottom line is that theta is just given very simply by the four-dimensional divergence of the tangent vector. So just to be clear, I've used the, I've talked about this twice already, I've just used this IPP that says that K mu multiplying this is half K to K mu, all of it being differentiated, but I have an object field, so this is zero everywhere, and therefore the derivative is going to be zero everywhere. Here we see something interesting, because I've made a big deal out of the fact that the transfer space is dimensional, and therefore to isolate it, to identify it, we need to identify an object field N that will allow us to get to one of the x dimensions and go from four to two dimensions. The expansion, we're going to think a little bit more clearly about this in a second, but the expansion is something that tells us whether the congruence of null GDSX is flying apart or coming closer together. It describes whether we have overall expansion of the congruence or contraction of the congruence. That can be calculated directly from K and no longer appears. So that's one sign, the ambiguity associated with N plays a role, of course, in defining the transfer space, but in the end, when you're interested only in expansion, that ambiguity completely disappears. So that's one, you know, place where, in fact, ambiguity or the non-uniqueness of N clearly doesn't matter. N just drops out of this calculation. N does not drop out of other quantities. For example, N, you know, would affect, the choice of N would affect with the effort shear tensor and the rotation tensor. But some pieces of that would not, you know, would not be dependent on the choice of N. So I'll come back to that theme a little bit later. What is the meaning of theta? Well, I hope to clarify this a bit more in the example I'll do next. But let's just say a few things. I mean, in the Hamming case, we got the interpretation for theta directly by comparing the fluid, you know, the little example that I give you about the fluid, you know, the kinematics of fluid relative to a fluid element. So we got exactly the same equation mathematically, and therefore the interpretation for theta was the same in the timeline case. So for a fluid, theta was something that measured the, well, that was a direct measure of the fraction rate change of volumes centered around the reference fluid element. In the case of a timeline congruence, theta was measuring the fraction change in cross-sectional volumes that's carried along with the congruence. So you look at the direction of the congruence, you define three-dimensional transfer space around it, you mark certain boundary, and that's your inventory volume, and you see what you see what happens in the evolution of the congruence, what happens to that volume, and theta measures how it changes. It measures the fraction rate of change of that volume. Well, here the interpretation has to be different because our transfer space, which was three-dimensional in the contact case, has become two-dimensional. And if we have that picture again, if we have transfer space that's two-dimensional, and we have expanded congruence like this, like one I have here, well, probably what will emerge for the interpretation of theta is that we're not going to be talking about cross-sectional volumes anymore, we're going to be talking about cross-sectional areas. In the background, the cross-sectional area would be the area associated with that sphere that's here represented as a circle. That sphere is expanding as congruence is moving out from the center. And how the area changes as it follows the motion of the null GDSX is what theta measures. So the interpretation for theta in this case has to be more or less the same as what we had in the other case, except for that loss of one dimension. And what we're going to be dealing with here, theta will have the interpretation of not measuring, you know, fraction changes in cross-sectional volumes. It's going to have to be, you know, measuring, you know, the fraction rate change of cross-sectional areas. The cross-sections are two-dimensionals, have an area, don't have volume. And what theta is going to be measuring is how fast that volume is changing as we follow the motion of the congruence. That's the interpretation for theta. Theta is, you know, representing some very important geometric feature of the transfer space. The transfer space does depend on N to get proper definition, but this particular question of how the area increases in time to follow the motion of the congruence is completely independent of n. So the next step in the development of this whole thing is to say, well, let's work out an evolution equation for theta. Or, and you know, we could also do it for shear and rotation that would be analogous to what we did in the time-like case. So we're going to work out an evolution equation for theta. We're called Reich-Jauduri equation once again, but now it's going to be the Reich-Jauduri in the null case as opposed to the Reich-Jauduri in the time-like case. So those steps are very similar to what Terry does before. In fact, identical. So the form of Reich-Jauduri's equation is almost identical to what we had before, except for a couple of little changes here and there. So we'll come to that in a few minutes. But what I wanted to do first is to try to make this very concrete by looking at a very specific example and really flesh this whole construction out a bit. Any questions before we move on?
The height surface is still topologically three-dimensional.
Right.
So in concentrating on the two dimensions that survive metrically, it seems there's something being left out. I mean, are we going to come back to quantum or plates?
No, it's a fact of life when you're dealing with null geometries or null height surfaces. So topologically, you have a three-dimensional surface, but one direction
within the hypersurface has no metric dimension because the ds squared in that direction is zero. So that's why we have topological three-dimensional surface, which metrically is two-dimensional. And there's just no way, something is left out, but that comes from the fact that ds squared is zero in that third dimension. So we just have to accept it, live with it, embrace it, celebrate it. But it does bring out all sorts of subtleties here. We come to terms with them in the case of a description of the geodesics themselves. As we move toward looking at hypersurfaces, well, this will be also a source of subtlety. When we try to, for example, introduce the notion of volume element on a three-dimensional surface, hypersurface, which happens to be null. What is the proper way of describing that? And is there a limiting procedure you can take from a three-dimensional case, from a time-like case to a null case where you see that, in fact, you are losing one metric dimension? So welcome to that.
When you took the transverse part of zeta, you took out an n piece that was you project. You produced something that was orthogonal to n and k.
Right. Okay, let me clarify this because it's an important point, and I just said some cryptic words about this before.
I find it useful from time to time to introduce a basis to decompose vectors, so let's do that. That's just an aside. So I have four-dimensional space-time. If I want to introduce a vectorial basis in that, I need four of them. So what I'll do is to, reintroduce k, reintroduce n as two of our basis vectors, and then I'll introduce two purely spatial vectors that will be pointing in the purely transverse directions. So I'll call them E1 to be consistent with the book. I'll call them E2 and E3. So we have four vectors, and their properties are such that, well, k is null, and so is n. N and k will have the strange normalization condition, which is not saying that they're orthogonal to each other, but something like that. I'm going to impose those two vectors are going to be purely transverse, which means that their product, and I'll use capital A as shorthand notation for label 2 or 3. This inner product is going to be 0, and this one also. So E2 and E3 are each orthogonal to k and n. And then I might as well go all the way and say that these vectors are orthogonal to each other. So I'll say that we have a relation like this between transverse vectors. So all of those conditions define what we normally think of as, well, it's not an orthonormal basis because of the two null vectors that we have, but, you know, apart from that, you know, it's a vector basis for four-dimensional vectors. So let's say I have vector C that has a component along K, a component along M, and two components along its transverse vectors. So that's the most general form that a vector can have in spacetime. The vector I really want to get in the end, the purely transverse vector, will have no component along K or M, and it will have only those components along E2 and E3. What is A? A is not, well, A, you know, in a real sense, is the component of C along K. But it's not obtained by taking the inner product of C with K. Because if we do that, we get 0 here, and we get minus 1 here. So B is the component of C along N, but we get that by looking at the inner product of C with K. That's by null vectors. It's a wonderful life, but you have to get used to it. The component, so A is the component of C along K, but you get it by taking the inner product of C with M. So I said something like that before, but I don't think I said it in a way that you would have recognized or, you know, been able to understand. So the point is that A is the component of C along K, but to isolate this, you need to work out the inner product, not K with M. So there's this sort of, you know, trade, you know, this sort of exchange property where if you want the inner product, if you want the component of the vector along a null vector, you have to actually look at the inner product along the other vector and so on and so forth. So in the construction we started with, this was automatically zero because we imposed all along that C had a vanishing inner product of K, and I used the word orthogonal to K, but now I have to be really careful with that kind of language. So this was identified to be zero to begin with, and this is the component I have to remove. I had to remove this guy. And the way to identify what it was to look at the inner product of C in the direction of M. And the C tilde vector, so this term was never here. We had a term like this. C had a component along N. No, sorry. This term was never here. C might have had a component along K, and I can kill it off by projecting or just stating that this inner product has got to be zero. And then when I kill off this term, I get C alpha is going to be purely involved in the transfer space vectors. So, yeah, that's the strange world of dealing with null directions. And you know, you just need to take the time to work through and think about it. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to do it. So any other questions about this?
Okay. So
let's go through this example I wanted to talk about. So I talked about flat space time, but let's do something a little bit more curvy. I'll talk about outgoing null through D6 in Schwarzschild space. So the Schwarzschild metric map here. And for my purposes, I won't even need to specify what that function f is. You know, for short, that's 1 minus 2m for r. Here, I can just as well substitute any function of r that I like. It won't spoil any of the things that I'll say before. So for example, f could be something that corresponds to a Schwarzschild black hole, or a Reissner-Norton black hole, or the Sitter spacetime, or Schwarzschild the Sitter spacetime. All of the spacetimes have a metric that can be written in that form. The only change, the only difference has to do with the actual form of the function f. So I'll be talking about Schwarzschild, but you know, as far as mathematics are concerned, it's just the same thing, whatever function f. Okay. Let me just write the metric in a slightly different form. I'll factorize an f, and I'll write the rest of it like this. And what I'll do is factorize the dt squared minus f minus 2 dr squared. Well, the reason for doing this is because this can be identified as a perfect differential, and this also can be identified as a perfect differential. So I'm going to define this to be the derivative of some function u, and this will be the derivative of some function v. And I can rewrite the metric in this form right here. U, well, is going to be simply c minus the integral of dr over f. And f being a function of r means that this integral can be evaluated. And v is going to be t plus the integral dr over f. And if you've been playing around with Schwarzschild spacetime for, you know, before, you'll recognize this as the integral that gives you r star. That's normally called the Church coordinate. And well, this is the same thing. So this is t minus r star. This is t plus r star. Okay, what's the point of doing this? I've lost everything. There it is. The point of doing this is that once you have a metric in that form, it's very easy to identify null QDs. And here I'll take a special case to look at null QDs that don't move in the direction of theta nor phi. So those are very much analogous to the ones that I was drawing before that just move off in the radial direction without having anchor momentum, without being the anchor directions. So let's consider what I call radial null QDs, and for them, d theta and d phi are zero. Talking about null QDs means that, so if we restrict our displacements like that, then the ds squared along those QDs is going to be given by this, but ds squared has got to be zero for null QDs, which means that you can get null QDs immediately by asking either that v be a constant along the motion of our null QDs, or that u be a constant. So we have two types of null QDs, one on which u is constant, because the u then would be zero, that guarantees that ds squared would be zero, or ones where v is a constant, telling us dv is zero and therefore ds squared is zero. And having restricted the motion to be in the right direction, we have two possibilities. Either they're going to be moving out or moving in. So let's look. The condition v is equal to a constant tells us that, well, it's easy to think of in terms of derivative. So dv equals zero tells us that along those two defects, dt has to be equal to minus f minus 1 dr. Well, presumably we want to move forward in time, so dt is positive. And if we want dt to be positive, I have to have dr negative to make the right side positive. So if we demand this to be positive, we find that dr is negative, and we're talking in this case about income. So this set of geodesics are incoming. And that's not the ones, those are not the ones that I want in this discussion, although, you know, I can consider them as well. So the ones that are defined by u equal constant, well, it's the exact same story. So now in this case, we have dt must be equal to plus f minus 1 dr, and guarantees that for those, dr will be increasing, r will be increasing, and therefore the geodesics are moving up. And those are outgoing geodesics. And those are the ones that I want. Okay. So we've had geodesics, those are the ones along which u is going to be constant. And if you're asking me, or if I should ask you, whether this congruence is hypersurface or orthogonal, you should have immediate answer. Yep. Wow. Sorry?
Is it just the two sphere?
Well, again, topologically, the surface should be a three-dimensional
surface, right? So it's going to be fully hit by spheres, to be sure. But what's the description of the hypersurface?
I'll just press my finger. Yep. What is it? Right. So the condition that u is constant on the non-geodesic means that we have a surface of constant u.
And then the only thing we need to, you know, verify is that this is really the surface to which the congruence is orthogonal. So we're dealing here with a specific case, a special case where the congruence is, in fact, at the surface orthogonal. We'll make that clear as we go along. Okay. So having identified the geodesics that we want to work with, we have to identify the tangential vector field. So how do we do that? Well, the tangential vector field will have to have components along T and components along R, but it will have no components along theta and phi. Let's see, which one do I want to factorize? I need to check the convention that I used here. Yeah, okay. What I'm going to do is to factorize the r dot. And what I'm going to have is t dot over r dot 1, 0, 0. And the point I want to make here is that I don't really care about the normalization of that null vector. It's a vector of zero length. If I'm multiplied by 2, it's still a vector of zero length. So I don't have to worry about, so I can choose the parameterization such that r dot is equal to 1. So the lambda that I want to pick for my geodesics is going to be, well, such that r dot is equal to 1, which means that I'm picking the lambda equals 1. Well, I pick this choice, I have to live with it, And I'll have to tell you that, in fact, this is a fine parameterized feature, because this is the condition that we've, you know, that we've put in place in the development of the whole thing. I was, you know, I wanted to deal with a tangent vector field that satisfies the geodesic equation in its conventional form. But let's make the choice first, and then we'll see that, in fact, it is an affine parameter. So R is equal to 1, T dot becomes DT dr, and then we have dr dr and d theta dr d phi dr. So choose, so what we've done here is to choose lambda to be r. To get k, we need to calculate dt dr. We know what that is. We worked out just before. And just take my word for now that this is really an affine parameter. The way to check this is to make sure that the vector field I'm going to give you in just a second actually satisfies the geodesic equation with a zero right side. It's a calculation you can do on the side. You know, take my word, you know, translate the feature. So dt dr, we had it over here. dt dr for u equal constant is equal to 1 over f. So in the end, the tangent vector field that we have to start with is 1 over f. Good. So, okay, so you can check that this is an null vector that satisfies the geodesic equation, so it's all good. We can see what happens when we lower the index. When we lower the index, we involve GTT here, which is F, so we get minus 1 here. When we lower the radial index, we get GRR, which is F minus 1, so we get that. This is minus the gradient of t minus f minus 1 r. Integral. Let's just get a different case. This is minus the gradient of u, which is minus the integral of t minus the integral of f minus 1. Because what I have to do is to take, first of all, the partial derivative of t with respect to x alpha, which is simply only 1 if alpha is equal to t. So that's what I get here. And then differentiate that with respect to r. You know. So the explicit listing of components agrees with the fact that k is written at the gradient. And that's my statement that we have hypersurface orthogonal congruence, because we can write down the normal vector. We can say that the tangent to the congruence is normal to hypersurfaces u equal constant. Okay. Well, the rest of it needs for us to choose the vector m. We need another null vector. And we need another vector that's not going to be aligned with k, but it's going to be aligned with, you know, another null direction. And fortunately for us, we've already identified another null direction. Here we're talking about the direction u equal constant, but another, you know, valid null direction is the direction v equal constant. So we might as well pick that to be the direction of the vector m. It's not the only possible conceivable choice, but it's a valid choice, and that's what we that's all p. So for n, what we're going to pick is something that's going to be proportional to the gradient of v. But it's not going to be equal to that, because that's violating the null dimension condition we need to invoke. And so what I need to have for n is going to be minus a half f grad v. which is minus a half f the gradient of t plus the integral dr of f. And the explicit listing components then is going to be that in the time direction we get minus half f, and in the radial direction we get minus a half. So the 1 over f that I get after differentiating with respect to r is canceled out by this f, and we only get 1 so half that's left over. And if you look at this, well, you can see quickly that this is really a null vector. And when you compute the product between this vector and that one, well, you can do it directly. You get minus a half from the time components, and that's minus a half from the radial components. And you get the required minus one. So this n is probably null. And this n is probably normalized. Well, now that we have n, and we've identified one possible n, I'll give you another one later to play around with. Now that we have that, everything has become completely algorithmic. So we have, you know, we have metric, we have space-time, we have two vector null vector fields in metric. We need to calculate the transverse projector. So that's a calculation you can easily do by hand, or you can use GR tensor. You can define your own tensors within GR tensor and ask it to calculate all its components. And if you do that, either way, you get something which is going to be diagonal in the usual Schwarzschild coordinates and will look like a two-dimensional metric in two-dimensional transverse space that's defined by, well, conditions T and R are constant. So that's what you would expect for something that has spherical symmetry. The transverse space is spherical, and that's the metric you get on that transverse space. So you calculate this, and then you can calculate B tilde. You know, you have H at your disposal, so you use it, and then you have the tangential vector field at your disposal, so you use that. So again, you can define all of this within MAFOLD, let it do the calculation. It takes far longer to enter the definition than it takes it to actually compute this stuff. You have to watch out for mistakes and things like that. Entering the definition is really the longest piece of procedure. But if you do that, you're going to find that this is also a diagonal thing, which has the following components. And we can summarize all this by saying that B tilde in this case, for this confidence in this space time, is equal to 1 over R H. That is very simple. It tells us that P tilde is pure trace. There's a Bouchier term that is, well, guaranteed by the spherical symmetry of the confluence, and there's no rotation. And as we're going to learn this afternoon, there's no rotation because we have hypersurface orthogonal confluence. If we want the expansion, we take the trace of this, we get a factor of 2. And what's the significance of this? Well, the 1 over R, well, needs to be there, but the key point is the factor of 2. That factor of 2 is the two dimensions of the transverse space. Because what's that? This is really 1 over 4 pi R squared dd lambda. Remember, the lambda is equal to R, 4 pi R squared. Why did I write it like this? Of course, this is much simpler. But what this tells us is that we are really talking about the fractional rate of change of areas associated with that two-dimensional transverse space. The areas are measured by R, or by R squared is the area you know, that's the definition of the Schwarzschild rate coordinate. And 2 over r, the factor of 2, tells us that the appropriate power here was not r cubed. We're not talking about volumes. We're talking about areas, and, you know, I might as well throw in a factor of 4 pi. I don't really need it, but it really illustrates the fact that I'm talking about areas. And when I differentiate that with respect to lambda, which is the same thing as differentiating with respect to r, I bring down a factor of r, and most importantly, I bring down a factor of 2 from the derivative, which is a factor of 2 that appears here. And it's that 2 that tells us that we're talking about fractional rate change of areas, not volumes. And it's consistent with the whole, you know, story so far. We're talking about two-dimensional, metrically two-dimensional transfer space. And we see that also illustrated in, well, the fact that obviously here the transverse metric is, you know, two-dimensional. We have two degenerate directions here, again, and that's associated with the two null directions where we don't have d s squared, where d s squared is equal to 0. So here, so I think that's, you know, that's a complete worked-out example. I mean, it's pretty simple, although, you know, those null congruences of Schwarzschild spacetime do play, you know, an important role when you try to understand the physical behavior of the metric and what it really means and so on, and talk about black holes. So those congruences are certainly very important. It is, however, a rather simple example, and what makes it, you know, especially simple is the fact that in this case we don't have shear and we don't have rotation. In the examples I've given you to work out, or in the problems I've given you to work out on the next more assignment, you're going to find that, well, there are more complicated situations where you will have shear and you will have rotation. Let's just make a final comment about choosing a different n. Here I've chosen one, you know, possible n among an infinite number of them, and I picked it because, well, I sort of recognized from the start that there was a breakdown between, you know, the null piece of the spacetime, the double null piece of the spacetime, and the angular transverse pieces. And I've used the symmetry, which is there in the spacetime, to actually, introduce or define my n in a way to respect that symmetry. So that's the simple thing to do, that's the sensible thing to do, but it's not the only thing you can't do. And in fact, you can sort of challenge yourself and work it out that if you had used a different n, you could have chosen a different n that still satisfied the conditions but would be different from the one that I wrote down before. And let's see, where did I put this? Yeah. You could try this one. That breaks this symmetry that I was talking about. So the time component would be minus f. There would be no rate component, but now it would be a phi component. If you tried this, well, first of all, you would see that this is a null vector, so it satisfies this condition. The inner product between this n and the k, well, only involves the time component, because here we don't have an angular component, and minus f times 1 over f is minus 1. So this vector n satisfies all the conditions that needs to satisfy, and therefore it's a valid choice. The only thing silly about it is the fact that I've obviously broken the symmetry that was there all along, but, you know, I can make life part of myself. There's no problem doing that. And if you go through the procedure, you're going to find that, well, Maple can calculate this just as well as in the previous case, and you can calculate h alpha beta for that new n, and it's going to look completely different. It's going to be a mess. There's going to be all sorts of components in all over the place, so it's going to look like a mess. It's still going to be, you know, a two-dimensional metric in the usual sense that the trace is going to be 2, it's going to satisfy all the properties, but the explicit expression in terms of short coordinates is going to be much more complicated than that. Nevertheless, it's a valid choice. B tilde also can be computed for this new n, and this also will look very messy compared with what we have here. So the explicit listing of components in Schwarzschild coordinates for the new n will be much more complicated than this for h and for B tilde. This relationship will be preserved. And that's the feature. because you know theta is independent of m. So therefore, this relationship that leads out this pure phrase is something that's invariant under reduction of n. And therefore, so this result would be unchanged. This result would be unchanged, but we knew that already. So you can still get exactly the same results in the end when you, you know, relate things to themselves when you, you know, when you reproduce the decomposition of B tilde in terms of transverse metric and all of that. And therefore, so that's another indication that, you know, the choice of n really doesn't matter. In the end, when you want to get the essential properties of the congruence, those by and large are independent of that choice. So that's the issue I'll return to this afternoon when we look at the Rey-Cauchy's equation. We're going to see that, you know, I'm going to say more clearly, more specifically, where the non-uniqueness of the description enters. I might as well say it now that, well, here we see explicitly and we prove the fact that theta was completely independent of n. The components of the shear tensor and the components of the rotation tensor in general will depend on n. But some statements are independent of n. The statement that sigma is zero is independent of n. The statement that omega is zero, if you have that, is dependent of n. The square of sigma is dependent of n. The square of omega is independent of n. So when we're going to be looking at the Rey-Cauchy equation, you remember that the Rey-Cauchy equation involves, well, the rate of change of theta involves theta itself, and then it involves the square of sigma and square of omega. All of those quantities are completely independent. And so that tells you in the end that even though there's ambiguity present in this whole discussion, it really doesn't matter for most of the questions of interest. You know, this ambiguity just doesn't play a role. It's not manifested in the end result. And even if you want to, you know, look at components of sigma and omega, the transformation properties of these things are well understood. In fact, I'm not sure if I've assigned, I think I've assigned one of the problems to actually work out this issue completely. So you're going to work out in the homework assignment how the components of sigma would change under the transformation on n, and how the components would change for omega. And you're going to see that if they're zero for one choice, they're going to be zero for the other choice, any other choice. And you can prove also the invariance of sigma squared and omega squared. And for all of those reasons, then it turns out that, as I said before, the ambiguity associated with the choice of n really is very harmless. It really doesn't, you know, prevent, you know, all of those developments from being done in largely non-ambiguous manner. Okay, so I think that's good enough for this morning. So what I'll do this afternoon is to pick up the story, revive the Rey-Cauchy equation, and also talk a little bit more about this connection between the hypersurface orthogonality and the vanishing of the rotation tensor. And after that, there will be time to move into hypersurfaces after that.